Hey, it's the Podomatic Podcast for September 3rd, 2014.
Best month ever.
And like Iggy Azalea says,
Work it.
It's true. This is the Podomatic Podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. Who is working it today?
Greg.
Mike.
Amanda.
Brian. The last time we had this particular configuration of podcasters, was it the first time we ever had this particular configuration?
The last time, yeah.
And that ended up being a pretty good episode, so that was pretty good. What episode was
that? We're back for more.
Was that cooking or something?
Might not have been. I don't know. I might have got it wrong.
This was the one with the grilling, the chilling and grilling.
Chilling and grilling.
I don't remember.
I don't know.
It was in that time zone.
this work talk is exciting for our listeners.
That's right.
Now,
so yesterday I was like cataloging some stuff, you know, my brains were turned to mush. How about you guys?
I don't know about that. But we hope that you all enjoyed your Labor Day. So in celebration of the Labor Day, that relaxing, chilled out, refreshing, invigorating Labor Day that we hope that you had, we're going to talk about things related to work. Now, if you think that's a drag, remember I said related to work. So who knows what we end up talking about? We end up talking about hanging out on the beach and drinking Mai Tais. Maybe
that's a tough job. Someone's got to do it.
Maybe your job is like a cocktail critic. Hmm? There is such a thing, right?
Donuts.
Ice cream taster.
Yeah, totally. Mike.
So I thought today I would talk about a book called The Intern's Handbook by Shane Coon. It's about a 25-year-old intern named John Lego who works for Human Resources Incorporated, which provides interns for most of the major corporations in America. But secretly, HR Incorporated is a society of assassins. Lego is the best killer in the organization. At the age of 8, he killed his abusive foster parents, and at the age of 12, he was recruited into the company. But, unfortunately, interns over the age of 25 are rather rare, so he has to retire. But his handler, Bob, sends him on one last mission before retirement at 25. to find out which one of the partners at a prestigious law firm has gotten hold of a list of people in the witness protection program and plans to sell it to the highest bidder. Lego is a movie buff, so that there are references to movies littered throughout the book, but unfortunately, it was rather a couple months ago since I read it, so only really one I can remember. He chose his name because Lago is the town in High Plains Drifter, one of my favorite Clint Eastwood movies. You should check it out. It is awesome. I really like the idea of an invisible assassin, like, you know, the kind of people you wouldn't really notice, kind of like the homeless guy in The Raid 2, which you should also see. It's written in a kind of like, I'm going to teach you the rules of surviving as an intern kind of book, you know, I mean, the intern's handbook, you know. Rule one, you know, how to survive as an intern, you know, in this crazy dog-eat-dog world with assassinations and explosions, cool. There's a lot of flashbacks to previous jobs, and it's interspersed with an FBI wiretap because one of his colleagues turns out to be an FBI mole. Dun-dun-dun. Minor spoiler?
Oh, spoiler alert.
I didn't say which one.
Dun-dun-dun.
Don't kill me. It's fast-paced and filled with a kind of dark humor. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of dumb if you think about it for too long. But I had a good time. And I also would like to mention that the cover is a skull and crossbones made out of office supplies, which is one of the coolest covers I've ever seen. Take it away, Greg.
So an important part of work, doing any sort of work, is the daily routines and rituals that make it all happen. No matter who you are and what you do, chances are you have your own little rituals. Brian and I, for example, spend all day housing coffee in the back room, and we begin each day with a quick game of Settlers of Catan.
Quick?
Yeah. You know, we blow through it. The importance of ritual is no different for artists. If you like to learn more about your favorite artist's rituals, from the mundane to the insane, now you can find a whole bunch of them condensed in a single collection called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work by Mason Curry. It's a fascinating survey into madness with just a short page or two for each of the 166 minds featured. among them novelists, poets, playwrights, composers, painters, philosophers, and scientists. It's cool to see the sheer variety of the schedules artists keep. Some wake up at dawn, others stay up all night and work. Some have day jobs, others just wake up and create like it's their job. And there are themes that crop up too, like addiction to coffee, alcohol, or pills, to name a few. But there's also a more healthy addiction trend that runs through of carefully timed naps, morning walks through the park, etc. Here are just a few examples. Ben Franklin started each day with an hour of naked time, writing or reading in his chambers.
Thanks for that mental picture.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. You know, now I want to scour my eyes with the steel wool. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he looks pretty good on the $5 bill. What is
$100 bill.
On that. Benjamin, that's right, yeah. 105. Where the hell did I get that?
Yeah. Okay. Get out of here, traitor.
I only use Chinese
money.
Go
back to Russia. The yuan.
Beethoven could not start work until he had his coffee made by himself from 66 beans per cup, exactly counted out. I've also heard that he dipped his head in a bucket of ice water before he composed, which the ice bucket challenge was
ice bucket challenge.
Truman Capote could only write lying down and couldn't begin or end a piece on a Friday. So there's a great infographic based on the book that shows a 24-hour timeline, and you can toggle between the time they spend either sleeping, doing creative work, doing their day job, or other. And if you hover over each little colored section, it will tell you more details, and we can link to it in the show notes. The infographic is titled slightly differently. It's called The Daily Routines of Famous Creative People. So the graphic features a "Not All Great Minds Think Alike" tag, and that's clearly true, but I think one thing that this book shows is that they all had a schedule of some sort. They say a lot of the pitfalls of young writers and artists is that they feel like they have to wait for inspiration. But I think it can be, it's becoming more and more clear that having a routine is what counts. Bam.
I'm reminded of two things. One is Sherman Alexie. I don't know if this is true, but he says that he actually, like, gets up every day, gets dressed, and leaves his house and goes to an office to, like, to write books. Because he said if he was at home, he would just do nothing.
I've heard some stand-up comedians do that. Like, Mike Birbiglia, I believe, has an office that he actually works
in. And then, did you guys see Boyhood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just like, well, I guess we could totally get down the rabbit hole of that movie, but, you know, there's the speech in the dark room that his photography teacher gives to him, and it's just like, listen, you think you're so cool just hanging out here? It's like, you need to put in the work, because having talent just isn't enough. Doesn't matter. Like, these mediocre people are going to outpace you professionally if you don't actually do the work. And then he makes him, even though he hates sports, what the teacher does is he makes him shoot the football game that night.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome moments in that movie. But
anyway, Amanda, what's happening over there?
I'm going to go way old school and talk about the book Sister Carrie. It's by Theodore Dreiser, who I have been a fan of his for a while because he is an Indiana writer, and I'm originally from Indiana. And he actually went to high school, like, 20 minutes from where I grew up. So I feel like he captures kind of that Midwestern voice better than a lot of people that try to capture that Midwestern voice when they weren't really raised in L.A. But so this book was actually published in 1900, so it's been a while. And it actually didn't sell very good when it first came out. They almost didn't get published because the basic premise is young girl from Wisconsin moves to Chicago. Her sister's already living there. She's married and settled. And her sister, Carrie, moves to Chicago to try to get a job and make her fortune in the world. And in the 1900s, there were a lot of office jobs for girls. And she finds one. But on the train, she had met this gentleman. And so she figures out that she can have a better life if she decides to live with him. So she kind of ditches her job and ditches her sister and goes and lives with this gentleman. She ends up having an affair. Like, they don't get married, but then she ends up having an affair with another married gentleman, and they move to New York, and she becomes this famous actress, and he ends up dying in poverty. And so Sister Carrie has a pretty good life through all of this, even though she doesn't always make the best choices. Her paramours tend to kind of fall by the wayside, which is partially why it wasn't very popular. A lot of folks had, think about 1900, this was very, you know, Victorian society and proper, and you don't talk about this. And, you know, here's Sister Carrie not only doing these racy things, but then being successful, because usually the books, you have to have the moral lesson that you learn, oh, I will not make this decision, and she has success and becomes this famous actress. So Dreiser caught a lot of flack for that when he was writing. He also has a very journalistic writing style, because he was a journalist, which didn't really help so much with Sister Carrie. That was his first novel. He hadn't quite gotten his style down yet, but then later he wrote An American Tragedy, which is about the death of another young lady that was very big in the papers at the time. You can see his journalistic style come through there. I like Dreiser. I think he's a great voice. He ended up moving to Hollywood, and he died out there at the age of 74. But definitely check out Sister Carrie, or American Tragedy is long. It's like 1,000 pages long, so you kind of have to commit yourself to that one. It's a really good picture of America at the turn of the 20th century. And if you feel like going to Chicago and getting a job, really get a job.
Well, and like one of the reviews for it said, you know, most girls that would make the choices that Carrie made would end up in the gutter.
She was an outlier.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, an anomaly.
Have you ever read Tom Drury?
I have not.
He's from the, I can't remember if he's actually from Indiana, but he writes this series of books that are kind of like what Faulkner did with his town in Mississippi, mm-hmm. but it's like this is an imaginary town in the Midwest.
Yeah, book club.
Now I have no transition. I just screwed up my transition big time.
Maybe you should take your headphones off.
Yeah, let's do more callbacks so you can't cut this.
Never mind. Well, you know, wait, I got a good transition.
Oh, boy.
Here's the
okay,
one.
Okay.
So the person that I'm going to talk about, Sister Carrie, sounds like a plot to one of his movies.
Mm, nice.
So I was going to talk about Carsick by John Waters.
Yeah, he could do Sister Carrie.
Totally, right? It could be a really fun
I do movie. Think they did a movie, like in the 50s. It's just called Carrie, and I can't remember who's in it, but I haven't seen it.
Does it have a prominent blood drop on people's
face? There is no blood.
I would watch that, Carrie.
There is no telekinesis, yeah.
I've seen that Carrie
a
couple of times.
I repressed that reference. It was like it's goblin. Yeah. My brain wanted to come out. It was like blood reference.
You can't keep Carrie down.
Just kept it down. So anyway, I was just talking about this John Waters book, and so what is John Waters' job?
To be creepy?
Director.
Yeah. He's a movie director. He makes movies. So he made Pink Flamingos. He made Serial Mom. And
Hairspray.
He made Hairspray, right? And one of my favorite movies ever, if you get a chance to see it, Female Trouble, which is maybe the perfect movie ever. After the economy collapsed in the late aughts, he couldn't get funding to make movies anymore. And for a long time, he was trying to make this movie called Fruitcake. It's about Christmas in Baltimore. You know, in poor neighborhoods in Baltimore, there's the tradition of the meat man. And what that is someone that goes around and steals meat and then goes door-to-door selling at half price. And, of course, people buy it because it's the holidays and they need a lot of meat. Hey, it's the meat man. And he's selling, like, half-price stolen meat. And, you know, somehow, like, the meat man gets into hijinks and Save Christmas. And the script is called Fruitcake, and he cannot get it funded. What he's been doing in the years when, instead of making movies, is he's been writing books instead. And also, he's rich and bored enough to decide to hitchhike across the United States, which is kind of crazy, but he's adventurous. He's 66. He decides, you know, I need to go on an adventure. I need something new.
Time out. Would you pick up John Waters if you saw him on the side of the road?
Well, I know who John Waters is.
That's true. I guess we know him.
But. We'll get into this. I think maybe at the end I'll just talk about like what John Waters is in my brain anymore. Mm-hmm. But like I'd seem like, holy F, that's John Waters, and I'd pick him up. Yeah. Yes.
From miles away. Yes. Spot him.
I like him. I don't really like his movies much.
I feel that. So he decides he's going to hitchhike and write a book about it. It's kind of like Eat, Pray, Love, except John Waters' version of it. Like, get a book deal first, then go on a trip. But the actual part of, like, the actual hitchhike that he does is actually only, like, one part of the book. And the first two-thirds of the book are actually fiction. And so the one is a novella about what are the best rides I could ever imagine. And then the second part, what are the worst rides I could ever imagine? And the last part is actually, like, the payoff, what actually happened when me, John Waters, hitchhiked across the United States. I'm right in the middle of the book right now, so I don't know how it ends, but I'm right at the end of the good ride section, and it is hilarious. It is so funny. It's like scenes from a movie. If you wish John Waters would make more movies, and you know, he's not making them. All these characters are just like these crazy scenes from these movies that he never got to make. And of course, if you know about John Waters, it's filthy, it's dirty, it's hilarious, it's everything.
How's his prose?
I think it's really good because one of the things people think about John Waters is he often does like stand-up shows, or he doesn't market them as such. He kind of marks them as like, he does like one-night stands where he does like spoken word, but it's basically really? John Waters doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. And he's really good at it. And if you think about his movies, too, like, he writes all the scripts. Like, he's a good writer. He knows how to tell a joke. It's really funny. And also, like, this is, I think this is the key to John Waters. Even though, like, he's dirty and he deals with taboo things or, like, things that are, I don't know, typically censored, his work is, like, always, like, really filled with, like, happiness and joy, and he loves his characters. Maybe it's just because he's a good writer. This is the good ride section. Like, I'm just getting, like, really, really good vibes from this book. Like, this book is just making me so happy. I'm loving it. And then, of course, one of the best good rides he has is when he gets picked up with someone who is an, quote-unquote, alternative librarian.
And sweet spot.
His name is Brian.
Her name is actually Bernice in the book. So
change the gender to.
And Bernice is an alternative librarian because she distributes censored paperbacks to people that want to read them. And what's funny is, like, the library here in Nashville, we have erotica, we have, like, gruesome true crime, we have every nutcase from both sides of the political spectrum that you can imagine, right? We get all those books, we don't censor anybody, we try to make everybody happy, but these books that Bernice distributes, some of them have to be just made up, right? Right? But they're just, like, beyond the pale. So she has, like, this network of collectors, and she distributes them throughout the United States. And actually, she got fired from her library job because she distributed them to high schoolers at her high school. So now she's the alternative librarian. And, of course, John Waters in real life actually collects, like, creepy old fetish paperbacks. So he's like, this is his good ride. He's like, great, I found a librarian that's into things that I'm into. Then they just start going off on all these different titles.
You made a new friend.
And what's also interesting about like John Waters' books is if you're a culture omnivore, which you probably are if you're listening to this podcast, like it's all just about like him talking about all the things he loves, and he has this very like broad and varied taste from like low culture and high culture. That's really like what he's all about, is like mashing up high culture and low culture together. So some of them like really are these alternative series of like these weird, like old, like creepy paperbacks. And then some of them are just like bizarre that made up. Like they cannot be real. Like I hope that they're not real. And that was a really great chapter that I liked. I'm listening to an audio. It's read by Waters himself, which I think really works because, like I was saying, he is a stand-up comedian. He knows how to tell a joke, and I think it's best when comedians read their own books because they know that they know their rhythm, they know where the beats are. So it's just really funny. If you need some pleasure reading, I recommend John Waters' books. His last book, Role Models, was also great, which is him just talking about his heroes, which totally ran the gamut from all kinds of like the lowest of low culture to the highest culture, and it was also like this smorgasbord of books, movies, and music for you to sink your brain into. So is Carsick. Maybe I'll report back when I get to the end of it. And if you also, it's really good to listen to at work because he's just talking about this really filthy, hilarious stuff and you can have headphones in and just smile at people as you listen to John Waters say horrible things that you could never say in public.
So what's tickling my fancy is that I went to go see As You Like It for Shakespeare in the Park this past Sunday. And, you know, I went because I like Shakespeare, but also, as we've mentioned, I went to support my partner who designed and built the set. But somewhere in the midst of it, I found myself really enjoying it. Everyone involved did a really amazing job. We had some folks visiting from Stratford-upon-Avon, the Stratford-upon-Avon Trust, which is the birthplace of Shakespeare, who were touring the country visiting 14 hand-picked Shakespeare festivals, and ours was one of them. And after watching the show, they said that they've never seen a better Rosalind, who's the main female lead, than ours. One thing they said is that I thought was really interesting is that there's nowhere in all of England that offers free live Shakespeare to the public like we do in America. So consider that.
Go USA.
Yeah. But I think part of what did it for me with this year's As You Like It was this Dave Olney guy, who's a legendary songwriter who composed songs for the show. They did an excellent job of weaving these songs in, and it helps break up the text really nicely. Admittedly, it took Shakespeare to bring Mr. Olney to my attention, but apparently he's the real deal. Tons Van Zandt listed him as one of his top five influences, and I'm a big Tons Van Zandt fan, so that carries a lot of sway. And it looks like Dave Olney is positioned to have a little mini revival. The Nashville Scene ran a cover story on him just last week. He's being featured at the Five Spot on Wednesdays, and he'll be at the library on September 9th. That's next Tuesday. for the Concerts in the Courtyard series with Marshall Chapman and R.B. Morris. And I know R.B. Morris from my days in Knoxville. He's a great sort of beatnik songwriter, poet, and playwright. So you heard it here. The National Library knows what's up. So yeah, that's my stuff for this week. What you got? What's your name, Mike?
Oh, that hurts, Greg. That hurts.
So good with the dates. Forgot Mike.
I'm not wearing one of those handy dandy new name tags. Today I'm going to talk about a urban fantasy series called Sandman Slim. Good times, because apparently I can only talk about lowbrow things with explosions this week.
That's okay. I like that.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
This week?
Oh.
Who are you?
Next week, I'm, recommending a 17th century play again.
So who talks about highbrow stuff on this podcast?
I did today.
You got some book from 1900.
Yeah. Like regularly.
On the regular.
Which at the time, it probably wasn't highbrow. At the time, it was controversial.
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my second episode, I mentioned a play from 1600 from, Spain or something. During that poetry thing.
We all have our snooty moments. Perhaps you, Brian?
I do not talk about Mahler.
Oh, yeah, that whole thing about Mahler. I don't know if I've heard anything by Mahler. Really.
The episode was about things that are long or big, and we both went to 19th century German composers.
Yep.
All composers around that time wrote really long symphonies. Yep. So it makes sense that we talked about that on that day.
I said I went Wagner, so I can't say anything.
Next week, art film. All right. Where am I?
Go, Mike.
Take two. Sandman Slim is about James Stark, a guy, a kid who dabbles in black magic, but he gets betrayed by his best friends and gets sent to hell while still alive. While in hell, he becomes a gladiator in their battle arenas, earning the favor of dastardly demons and the attention of Lucifer himself. After about 11 years, so he gets in there when he's about 19, and he returns when he's about 30. He returns to Earth and breaks out of hell, yearning for revenge, armed with cool weapons like a Na'at, which is a cross between a sword and a whip, a knife that can open any door, and an amulet that was implanted inside him that allows him to teleport around wherever he desires. Good stuff. Characters that are in the book include the 18th century alchemist Count Cagliostro, which was an actual guy. In here, he's an immortal guy. I think there's a series of vampire books where he's a vampire. He's always been this kind of immortal weirdo in fiction. A beast called a jade who drinks people's liquefied organs and various aspects of God. Like the Intern's Handbook, each book in the series is littered with movie references. Ones that come to mind include one of the main characters is a severed head. And throughout one of the books, Stark calls him Alfredo Garcia, after the movie Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, which made me giggle every time he said it. His main hangout in Los Angeles is the Bamboo House of Dolls, which is named after a women in prison movie. I thought it was House of Dolls, but it turns out Bamboo House of Dolls is an actual movie, too. He lives above a video store, which is amusing because, apparently 6 years ago, video stores still existed. And one of these video store employees is always watching an exploitation or grindhouse movie, which is pretty fun. I really love this series. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of urban fantasy, like in the vein of Jim Butcher or... But it's a little darker, and his humor is a little bit more sarcastic. It's been compared to Richard Stark, who the main character is named after, and Jim Thompson, which I wouldn't quite agree with because both Jim Thompson and Richard Stark write really, really dark. Like, I need to take a shower afterwards. This one, not so much. I've read every book in the series and have not been disappointed. And I thought I would like to mention that the day this is being recorded... Actually, the day before this is being recorded, or the day that you get to see this, haha. The latest book in the series, The Getaway God, comes out, which I'll probably be buying at some point. Good stuff. Kind of dark. This entire book set in hell. Oh, yeah, my favorite book is called Devil Said Bang, where he goes back to hell. And the Hellions are really amusing. Like, hell reforms itself to look like L.A. for him. So he goes to,
It's not such a new concept.
Yeah, he gets a spot that even I can recognize. Beverly Hills, where all the really good Hellions live and stuff. It's fun and silly. It's fun and kind of dark too. Anyway, the Sandman Slim series by Richard Cadry. What do you got, Amanda?
Okay, my tick of my fancy is for all the folks that come to the Popmatic podcast to get all their current events. You can go to Comedy Central to learn all your American history by watching a show called Drunk History. This is hosted by Derek Waters. I think it's on Tuesday nights. I usually just watch it on demand. So the premise is Derek is the host, and then there's usually a narrator who has spent the better part of an evening drinking as much as physically possible, tequila, vodka, whatever they want to drink, that but they are completely wasted. And then they explain to you a story about American history. And in the background, you have, like, they flashback and forth. The actors, like, act out exactly what they're saying. Like, if they spit on themselves, like, the actors spit on themselves. And it's really hilarious. But the actors, I mean, they're great actors. It's like Jack Black and Johnny Knoxville and even John Lithgow and Winona Ryder have been in the scenes in the background. And just some of the stories are, we learned about how Walt Disney came to form his company. We learned how surfing became popular in Hawaii. We talked about Thomas Jefferson and John Adams feud, how that went back and forth. We learned about what happened with Benedict Arnold. I mean, and it's like really accurate history. It's just...
And the formation of Coca-Cola as a native Georgian, I can't, let that go.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Yes.
So if you, and I mean, it's accurate history. If you check it out, they're telling the right story. They're just embellishing it a little bit as they go. But it is highly enjoyable and funny. And if you need history, that's the way to learn it.
So they actually get drunk for real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have one guy like got up. I can't remember who it was. Somebody got up, went off camera, threw up, and then came back, drank more, and finished his story. That's classy.
This is kind of like a remake, I think. Of
there was a web series.
There was a web series on YouTube that came out first.
Exactly. I think it's the same guy, but I mean, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if they're still doing this, but originally they had gotten like college history professors drunk and then had them just recount like a story.
Ooh, that could be fun.
It wasn't like scripted at all. It was just like they're talking about the top of their head. And so that would actually, I don't know if it's scripted now, but that would actually happen.
I would think it would have to be because like the folks that I've seen that be the narrator, like I wouldn't think that they would be hardcore American history people.
Yeah.
Because they're usually comedians.
Yeah, they're usually stand-up comedians
actors,
who probably don't know the,
Yeah.
Who can all drink like fish, though.
Yeah, they are very excellent at drinking.
What they lack in knowledge is.
Yeah. So it's funny.
I do that for the podcast every week.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't do that. We record this on Metro Time. I am the soberest of the sober.
Except for the coldness. High on NyQuil.
Yes, exactly.
That's legal.
Mucinex or whatever.
Antihistamine. I don't have mono, honest.
He has duo.
It's worse.
I feel pretty good, sorry.
So what's tickling my fancy is the new teaser for the new Grimes music video. A few weeks back, she leaked this song called Go. And it was a track with her and this dubstep producer named Blood Diamonds, who she's friends with. And, it really kind of sounds like a radio R&B song and this, like, sort of dubstep song with the wub, wub, wub break, like, just, like, mashed together into two songs. And it's the first new Grimes track since she kind of hit it big. And really, I don't know if the song really works. It's like, the dubstep part just seems kind of pasted in. And the pop part was really kind of mainstream. And like someone who's really into Grimes is kind of like, I hope she doesn't go like this pop. Like, wait, it's way too pop for me. But then Grimes wrote it for Rihanna, but her people like turned it down. But she had to end with Rihanna because Grimes is... managed by Jay-Z and Beyonce's management company, Roc Nation. And though I didn't like the song so much, super excited about the video is because Grimes has a really creative visual taste. It's like really unique. And I think now she actually finally has the financial means to really do whatever she wants. So I think this video is going to look really cool whenever it drops. And of course, what happens whenever you... get to be managed by Jay-Z and Beyonce's company, you're kind of everywhere. So besides doing a teaser for the song, she's on a track on the new Bleachers album. Bleachers is a new solo record by the guy from Fun, Jack Antonoff. You like Fun, don't you?
I do like Fun.
So his new project's called Bleachers, and Grimes has a track on there. And then also she has a cameo in the new, did you say it? Haim? This is how out of it I am. That band Haim, like the rock band?
Yeah, because it's like Corey Haim. That's what they're named after him.
So she has a cameo in the new Haim video for My Song 5, the one with ASAP Ferg. She's in there, too. So she's everywhere. Get ready, because this video is going to drop and this new album's going to come out. Everyone's going to know the name Grimes. New Grimes track, Go, with Blood Diamonds, video teaser.
I just wanted to add, too, from the... person, what was the person you talked about last week? What was her name?
FKA Twigs?
Yes, because I listened to that, and that's actually a cool album. And when I looked at the cover, I have seen it everywhere, too. Like, I was, oh, yeah, I've seen that everywhere. But I listened to it. I actually liked it. I thought it was really good.
I thought the clip that you showed had in it was good.
Yeah, I've listening to the whole record a few times. Mm-hmm. It's very R&B.
But I just like the play of the background against her vocal. Like, I thought that was it was a lot of fun rhythm play, which I enjoyed.
Good stuff.
I like that first Grimes record, but the video the main video that came out where she's on the beach, like, swinging her hair around and there's a sword.
Genesis.
People, like, really liked that video, and I didn't really get it at all.
That is the video that turned me on to Grimes. And so they were talking about the video Genesis. And one of the reasons why I was like, what the F is this? And that's why that just took me down a path, because I wanted to know what it was. I was also, that video launched the career of rapper Brooke Candy, who is the chick in the shiny armor. So that.
I do love one Grimes song, but I don't remember the title, where she's like walking down the street or something.
Probably Oblivion.
Oblivion, yes. I listened to that on infinite repeat a couple of times.
So a lot of people said that those two singles off the Grimes record, Genesis and Oblivion, are really good, but the rest of the record was so-so. But I like the whole record.
I loved Oblivion so much. I tried to listen to the other things, and I wasn't really impressed. But, you know, maybe this new one is.
It's always magic how that works. How you have such a great, awesome song or two songs, and then the rest of it's just like.
That's what I like about the modern era, where you just buy the one song that you like instead of being, like, tricked into buying the rest of
the. Well, I just think about when they're making the album, and, like, all these songs came from mostly the same source, and yet one is just awesome, are just, like, filler.
there's always one song that stands, like, jumps out mm-hmm. at you right away, but for me, like, I have to listen to an album, like, several times before it, like, really sinks in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that.
Committing to the whole album, yeah.
People write off a lot of material because, you know, they're not willing to sit down with it. Mm-hmm. Not to say that.
Greg just said you were stupid and lame.
Yeah, he's implied that word.
I mean, I do that too.
You know,
I'm gonna
this
cry
is the second
later,
time
so
this podcast.
Okay.
You know, cool, Brian. Cool, Greg.
So,
I'm revoking our friend card. You're not getting my Christmas cards.
This.
I do that sort of thing all the time. Too. I'm not. Yeah. Not to say that. There's
What I'm wondering is, I think that there in pop music, I think there was a time decades ago when you were writing a single because you wanted a hit on a 45. Mm-hmm. You wanted a radio hit.
Yeah,
50s, and then it became albums, and then it's back. I've heard this.
Yes, and then it became albums, and I think, like, rock people and jazz people, maybe like me and Greg, are in this whole, like, album thing, album as a piece of art, people making an album, like, as a piece. And now, because we consume music as singles more digitally,
Spotify.
Are people writing that way? Artists writing that way?
I think it depends on the genre, like you said. Like, I think pop music, no. But I think there's still rock albums, there's still jazz albums, there's still folk albums that are out there, singer-songwriter albums that are a concept as a work of art as opposed to 3 minutes of fun.
New Grimes song sucks. I hope the album's better.
Oh.
No, it's all right. Hey, team.
Shut up.
Yo.
We have any corrections from last time?
Nope.
None that I know of. If we got something wrong, please leave it in the comments. You might have noticed a little clip at the beginning that is from Iggy Azalea's song Work, which I think that was kind of like a hit song. I don't know.
Who's Iggy Azalea? What? She's big now?
It's kind of been my jam last couple weeks, days.
Is she from, like, New Zealand or Guam or something?
Your nerdiness has been unmasked.
Hey, you know.
For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Thank you, Adam Dean. Your theme music
sustains us.
listening to more Blut Angle lately.
Why do I know that? Do I know that person?
He's in Kinder Diesenstadt.
Kinder Diesenstadt? What?
Yeah.
That is good, yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Future pop.
It's this genre where it's too dancy for the goths and too goth for the dainty kit crowd.
I think I know that stuff.
It is awesome.
You like VVN Nation? Like
VNV Nation. Yeah. Yes.
You like them?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That song called Retaliate, which was my favorite song of last year.
Cool. We need to hang out outside of work.
We should.
Mike doesn't live in the basement.
And listen to almost dancey music together and not dance.
Well, I've been saving this, but there's like Industrial Monsters of Rock tour out right now. Uh-huh. And it's Skinny Puppy, Howl Jaw, VVN Nation, and Youth Code. Ooh. And I love Youth Code, but that's probably might be a little too hardcore for you. But like, okay. Youth Code is like, I'm just going to have one of these Tickle My Fancy segments where I like have a spasm about Youth Code because I love Youth Code is like.
It briefly went through an industrial phase, but I think I like more of the industrial metal of KMFDM or Rammstein, or that sort of thing.
I like people that make music with tools.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at.